You're listening to episode 102 of the Writing Life podcast from the National Centre for Writing, a weekly podcast for anyone who writes. Hello, my name's Simon Jones.
And I'm Steph McKenna.
It's the 10th of July 2020 here in Norwich, and we're still recording this from home. But Steph, I believe you actually made it back into Dragon Hall briefly this week.
I did. It was so nice. I popped in this week to say goodbye and good luck to our colleague Hannah, who works in the programming team. She's about to go on maternity leave. So I got the opportunity to see her briefly in Dragon Hall, and it was so lovely. It was just, Dragon Hall still has that new car smell, even though it's been there for, well, not the actual hall itself, but the new extension. We've been there for, I don't know, 18 months, maybe longer. And it still smells like it's brand new. It's lovely.
The hall smells more like it's been there since
1427. Yeah, doesn't have a new car smell, but it does smell of sort of old wood, and that has a lovely smell as well. Actually, I'm just missing the smells of Dragon Hall on top of everything else.
Yeah, exactly. And we're still a little ways away from being able to open Dragon Hall up to public events, unfortunately. So that's still in the future. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I know the operations team is monitoring all the government advice as closely as they can, and when we can start doing stuff again, we will.
Oh, I can't wait, really. It's we work in such a lovely environment, actually. We're very lucky, and I can't wait to be back there and to welcome people back for events.
Yeah, Dragon Hall is a bit of a grander office to work in than our bedrooms, isn't it?
It is. I'm certainly missing it. I'm missing everyone there, and I'm missing going in. But hopefully, sooner rather than later, we'll be back.
So on the show today, we have writer, philosopher, artist Eva Meyer, who was our writer in residence back towards the end of 2019, which was when we could indeed do things in Dragon Hall and people could travel around the world.
Yes. So I remember at the time actually having Eva to stay at Dragon Hall, and we held an event with her. She was talking about her book Animal Languages, which had just been translated by Laura Watkinson, which is this amazing look at how animals communicate and what they have to tell us about our own languages. So Eva's a big fan of animals and of wildlife. And it really comes into play in this book. It's a really great read.
Yes, definitely a podcast for people who like their animals. But there's also really interesting stuff about her kind of daily schedule and why she sometimes finds writing to be easy. And what she's meant by that when she's occasionally said it, and I think other writers kind of look at her with raised eyebrows. But her approaches to editing, how she approaches the first draft of a novel, where she finds inspiration, and how routine helps her. And it's a very wide-ranging conversation with Kate Griffin, our associate program director. So yeah, this conversation was recorded late in 2019, and we're very pleased to have Eva on the show.
Eva, my first question. Yesterday evening you did an interview with an event with Daniel Harnan, who was interviewing you and Brekke Hofstede. And also today you were talking to Patrick Barkham about writing. And every time they ask you about writing a book, you say, oh, it was easy. Could you tell us why you find it so easy to write books, and maybe share with us some of the secrets of your writing practice?
I think it is easy and hard at the same time. So part of why writing is easy for me is that I have a very clear daily routine. So I write every day, usually around the same time, and I write both fiction and academic papers and books. And I usually do a bit of both every day for a couple of hours, and then I go and do something else. So I walk with the dogs, or I go for a run, or I play some music or something like that. And that works very well for me, because then after a certain time you have a book. So it's really easy like that. Yeah. But the other thing that is really rewarding actually for me in writing is that the story usually carries me. So it's very much, especially writing fiction, is for me very much a way of tuning in to the story, listening to the characters, trying to be the vessel that carries the work and makes it into something. And I really enjoy that process. Sometimes it's almost like, for example, with my newest novel, that's coming out early next year. It's even a bit like being in a film. So I enter the film again and work with that. And of course, every book also has its challenges, and what that challenge is differs between books. It may be something with the characters, it may be something with the flow, it may be something with the sort of the way in which the ideas and the story are related. In some books carry a lot of theory, and then it's sort of the challenge to completely hide that in the story or in the dialogues, in a way that it's not a pamphlet or something. So of course it's not just easy, but I find it, especially with some books, when I already know what I'm sort of going to do, then it's simply a matter of doing it and sort of being true to the story. And also, I often find that people, it's also a matter of sort of putting aside your own image of what things should be like, or the idea of possible readers or other people's opinions, and basically putting aside your ego and really, tuning in to the work. And I quite enjoy that, because it's sort of, it's not exactly a form of meditation, because it's work and it's conscious, but it sort of has this similar flow, and that's a joyful process.
And you said, and then there's the book, but how much do you edit, or is your first draft ready to go?
No, I edit quite a lot, actually. So when there's I try to not think about anything when I write the first draft. But then, of course, when I reread it, I begin thinking about things. How does this work? Does it make sense? What should I add here? What is this character doing there? Sometimes even this could lead to murdering some of the characters, in the sense that there's probably a special place somewhere for all of these characters that got written out of the books.
There's definitely a short story.
They're sort of waiting. Some are patient, others are quite upset as it goes. So yes, I rewrite a lot, and I really believe that the book sort of, I think that the second version of a book is quite close to what the final version will be, but still it sort of depends, because sometimes I still add a lot, and other times I edit more. But the book I was mentioning today, which is an essay about depression, that one was actually quite finished already after the first or second draft. So it's also not a very long book, so that has a little bit to do with it. But I also think that in that particular case, it was something that I'd been thinking about for a very long time. So actually my thoughts were quite finished, and that meant that they also already had like a shape in language. I had already found words for what I wanted to say, and that makes it easier. I think especially with the novels, I sometimes need more time to sort of get to know the characters. For example, what I really like is when I'm writing the first version of a novel, to just get the characters in a room together and have them talk to each other. So, and I'm conscious of that. So there might be quite a lot of that in the first version. I really like long dialogues, and then my editor or publisher is reading that, and they're a bit like, well, Eva, you know, they're going on and on and on and on. And I read back and I'm like, yeah, maybe they are. So, and I find that amusing, but not everybody does. But then it's, again, it's a matter of being precise and finding the exact right words. And that often means that some of these scenes have to go, but it, for me, it has the advantage because because they're talking to each other, I get to know them quite well. So I like that. And then you give them a conflict or a little puzzle or something, and then it's quite clear how the relationships are for me, and that sort of helps me to finish the story.
And you also write a blog. And it looked, when I checked your website, it seemed like you were writing every day. You'd certainly already mentioned Norwich. Why do you do this? And what do you write about, and what inspires you to do this blog?
I actually began writing the blog. I was writing songs mostly at that time. I began writing it in 2007, and I was playing a lot as a singer-songwriter. And obviously that includes language. And I was also working as a visual artist at that time. And my visual work also often has to do something with language. But I kind of felt like there was more to it. And in order to find out whether or not I wanted to write more, I decided to just write more and sort of set this this daily goal of either writing a short observation, or sometimes it's also pictures or photographs or drawings. And in the beginning, it did really help me to get going with writing. And I think it's nice because you're writing for an audience when you write a blog. And it's something that enables me to use all the material that I see daily, so all the stories that surround me, to find another outlet for that. And it's a lot of it is very short and fluid and kind of fleeting, because that's the nature of the medium. But I kind of like it as a way of, I don't know, showing others a bit about how I perceive the world, and making them see it too. And life is very absurd. There's a lot of things you can you can see every day that are so interesting and beautiful as well. So I enjoy doing it, and I think it helped me with writing my first novel as well, because I already sort of had this habit of writing daily, and that helped a lot.
Mm. The first of your novels that we've been able to read is Bird Cottage, which was published in the UK in 2018,
yeah.
Translated by Antoinette Fawcett. The novel is about the life of the ornithologist Len Howard. I was wondering how you came across her, and also why you chose to write a novel about her rather than a biography, for example.
I came across her work when I was studying philosophy. I was writing my master's thesis about political communication with animals, non-human animals, which is to some may seem like a very strange subject, and some of the philosophers at the University of Amsterdam certainly thought that was a very strange subject, but that's good, you know, it's good if some people are not completely convinced, because that sort of makes your work better, because then you have to defend it and use better arguments. Anyway, I was writing about animals and politics and also language, and I had been telling people about this, and a friend of my mother's actually recommended Len Howard's books. And she wrote two books, Living with Birds and Birds as Individuals, that were quite successful. They became bestsellers. But afterwards, she was forgotten, and I had never heard of her. So I ordered one of her books, and I was immediately struck by the way Howard wrote about birds and lived with birds, because she, in the time when she wrote these books, the dominant way of studying birds was behaviorism, and that means studying the birds in laboratories where they are separated from each other and, for example, cannot fly. So it really limits them in their social behavior and also freedom of movement and other ways. And Howard thought that this would always influence the results of this research. And since then, this has been proved in different species of birds. And it's quite common sense, actually, to see this. But other researchers have done studies about this. Anyway, Howard wanted to do it differently. So she decided to buy a cottage in Ditchling in Sussex and to open the windows so that the birds could fly in. And they did. So what she soon found out, because her initial interest was studying bird song. Howard was trained as a violinist, and she was very interested in the musical aspects of these birds singing to each other. But she soon found out that they didn't simply sing for the joy of it or the beauty of it, but that they were actually communicating with each other and with her. So very early on, when she arrived in Bird Cottage, when she'd been there only a couple of weeks, one of the, I think it was a blue tit, one of a pair of blue tits flew into her house and began making loud noises and flapping her wings. And Howard was like, oh, something's going on here. Something's wrong. So she followed the bird outside, and it turned out that the nesting plates of this bird and her partner had been broken. So the bottom part fell out, or maybe a cat took it out or something. Anyway, the eggs were on the ground and they were still intact. So Howard put the thing back, and she put the eggs back inside, and she arranged it so that they could enter and that it was safe and everything. And then she went inside, and she really felt like this was a revelation. Oh, they say something to me. They are actually asking me something, and I understand that. And that sort of set the tone for the rest of her life in Bird Cottage. So the birds came inside her house. Some of them nested under the roof, and she made all these nesting places with cardboard boxes also in her room, and they used that. Others did not sleep inside the house, but just came in during the day or had sort of social visits with her whenever they felt like that. And some stayed distant, while others really became what you could call friends. There's, for example, Boldhead, one of the older male great tits, one of her the earliest birds that she studied. And in the last days of her life, of his life, he always came to her, and he pretended to come for a nut, but he never ate the nut. He just sat on her lap for quite some time before he went away again. And there are lots of these stories, and it's not just Howard's relationship with the birds, but also because they were so close to her, she was very she could study their relations with one another really well. So it was very fascinating to come across this research from the perspective of the philosophical research that I was doing. And then I was also fascinated by Howard herself, because in her books she is well aware of the fact that people think that she is this kind of strange bird lady, but she still finds it worthwhile to be studying the birds in that way and living in that way, because it was actually quite an isolated life in terms of human relationships. She did have friends, but she couldn't really have too many visitors in the house, because that would scare away the birds. So there were all of these signs on the road to her house saying that everybody should stay away. And practically as well, there was just a lot of cleaning involved in the house because the birds pooped on everything. And writing was difficult, because as soon as she lifted the towel from the typewriter, all the birds would sit on the keys of the typewriter or her fingers. There are some really beautiful pictures or photographs of that as well. So so I was intrigued by the question of why someone would move from being a violinist in London, which is already quite an extraordinary profession for a woman in the 1920s and 1930s and 1940s, and why someone would move from that kind of life to this remote life in a cottage with birds. And of course, someone should write a decent biography of Lan Howard, because her work and her persona definitely deserve that. And also because I think that we can learn a lot from her insight and her way of living with the natural world, which is now especially important as we are having to reinvent ourselves as humans in this age of climate change and ecological collapse. So someone should write a biography of Howard, but I wasn't going to be that person, because I was in her story mostly interested in the kind of emotional truth that guided her actions. And it's also, of course, because I am writing academic work about communication with animals and a language of animals, I sort of felt I had that covered also. And I like to combine the two. I would never only want to do nonfiction or academic work. I really like the freedom of a novel. And I think that Howard was a really wonderful protagonist, in a sense, also because she had her difficulties and she just really seemed like an interesting character. And now, of course, when I tell you this, because you ask me the question, this is sort of what I think, why I chose to do it in this way. But in the end, I think that these decisions, for me, the decision to write a novel is very intuitive and sudden. I just suddenly know when I'm taking a walk or when I'm doing something, I'm like, oh yes, this is the story that I should be writing about. And it was the same with Lan Howard. I thought, oh yes, I should write a novel about Howard. And I like that that way of maybe even letting the novels choose me. And of course, it's me choosing the subjects, because it sort of probably follows from things that I've been working on and writing about. But I think there's something magical about how a story comes to you. And there's something magical about being able to enter these worlds that do not exist before you write them. Mm. It's the same, actually, when you read a book. It's very, it can really be like being in this different world. And that can be simply because the main character is someone from a very different social setting, but it can also actually be a different world. And I think as a writer, you have that same sensation, but then maybe intensified, because you're there all the time, and you need to walk around a lot before you can write the story about that place. So you're more in that world than ends up in the book.
Did you have to do much research for the book?
Yes and no. On the one hand, I had already been doing a lot of research about birds and communication with animals and sort of the underlying themes that I wanted to discuss in the book, which are not only animal-related themes, but also more general themes about language, but also, for example, about music. I've always played music, and I think that Howard is my first character who is also a musician and also communicates in that way. So the bigger themes I'd already been writing or thinking a lot about. But then the life of Lan Howard was, of course, new to me. And there's not so very much known about it. Mm-hmm. So the facts that we do know are fairly random. For example, her father was an accountant, but he was also a poet. He wrote really long Victorian poems that are still, you can still find them online and read them. And I went to visit Bird Cottage, and And there was also a very small archive, which was basically just a blue folder with some short stories written by Howard, and also some postcards from her sister and some newspaper articles with interviews and that kind of stuff. So that, and of course I looked her up online and found out some stuff about her family, and there are also some photographs to be found, but there wasn't that much. So it's and I also decided, because I think that if you are going to write a true biography, there will be more. For example, I think a great grandson of her sister or something was in touch, and so there are some people who are who would know more about the family, and I didn't do that kind of research. What was really important for me was to be in Ditchling and to just look around and smell and listen to the sounds and find out whether or not the birds were still there. And I also visited the actual bird cottage, but they changed the house a lot, so I didn't really get the feeling of the I didn't really get to see the bird cottage in which Howard lived. But still, it was very good to be there, and it was good to get a sort of poetic understanding of the landscape by being there. And I think that one of the challenges for that book, because it's the only novel I wrote about someone who actually existed, was sort of that thin line in between wanting to do justice to Howard as a person, because I respect her and she deserves that, but also wanting to make certain literary decisions because the story asks for that. So it was kind of like I can make her fall in love, but I can't I can't, for example, make her fall in love with a woman, because that would be too that wouldn't really be based on anything, and then it would be sort of not right for not doing justice to her life story. So it was kind of this balance. And in the end, the Len Howard in the book is very obviously my creation, but I think that at some important sort of points, for example, her relations with the birds and all of that, I think I got the feeling right, or at least I hope that, and we cannot ask her, so I can only hope for that. But the thing is, if I think about my own life and imagine that someone would write a novel about that sometime, then that's also okay. If people do it in a genuine and honest way, then yeah.
The translator into English, Antoinette Fawcett, she also did a lot of research for the book, including, going to the various places. She's written an essay about this, about the research she did for the translation in the Asymptote magazine. I guess she had a different challenge in a way, because she was translating a book from Dutch into English, but a book that's set in England, and so trying to authentically domesticate it, her research was, I guess, looking at how people spoke at the different times that the book covers, which is 1900 to 1973. She really went into a lot of depth with that. I was wondering whether you collaborated with her at all, whether you worked with her on the translation.
I don't think we... I mean, Antoinette emailed me, of course, with suggestions and questions and... But not so much. I think these were more factual things. For example, Paul, who is an ex-lover of Howard and who's coming back to visit her, was a pilot in the war, and then Antoinette asked, were there actually pilots there? You know, these types of because she'd really been looking into that in the specific area where Howard was. So these types of things she would discuss with me. But I think in finding the language, she very much made her own decisions, and in my feeling stayed very close to the original, in the sense that she also captured the musicality of the book, the tone of the book, and the lightness of the book. And I think that it's very special and joyful to be able to read yourself in English. That's so beautiful, you know. I could never do it in that way. So yeah. So I was really lucky, I think, with her as a translator. Yeah.
And you've got a new book out in English, Animal Languages, this time translated by Laura Watkinson. This is a non-fiction book, though, isn't it? Could you tell us a little bit about the book? Is it inspired by your academic work?
It's based on the first half of my PhD thesis, which is about political animal voice. And when I was doing the research for the PhD thesis, I came across so many wonderful and interesting studies about non-human animal languages that I just felt that I needed to do something with that outside of the academic world. And I basically collected many of these stories. In this book, I write about studies about animals who use language. For example, prairie dogs describe humans who enter their territory really in detail. They tell each other about the color of their t-shirts, the color of their hair, the speed with which they approach, how tall they are, and also if they're carrying something, an object like an umbrella. And they speak about many things in their lives, also dogs, and their sentences, which are in short, sharp barks, sounds, or sort of also their language also has a grammar, so they use nouns and verbs, and prairie dogs are ground squirrels, just for people who now think of dogs who roam the prairie. But these animals have a very complex language that we don't know anything about. What I was just saying now only refers to their alarm calls. But the interesting thing is not that their language is, or it's not, they're not the only species who have a very complex language, just that their language has been studied in detail by someone who thought, well, you know, maybe there is a language. And for many other animal species, we know something. We know that dolphins have names, and parrots have names, and bats have names. And it's also, we're learning so much about this at the moment because we have all of this technological equipment. Because, for example, if you think about the sounds of dolphins and bats, then most of it is impossible for us to hear with our human ears. So this new technology is helping a lot in that sense. So there are many, many more studies, and I discuss them in the book. But what is interesting is that animals also speak about us. So that also sort of presses us to think, or should press us to think, about a lot of ethical questions related to these other animals. What is the ethical importance, for example, of the fact that chickens name the humans with whom they live? You know, so they have a perspective on us. And a lot of these studies of animal language are on one species and then one aspect of their language. But if you combine them all, you actually see that there's this great living world of beings who have their own cultures, emotions, ways of thinking about things that is usually for many people hidden. And language is especially important because that was for a long time seen as what made us human, as kind of the defining characteristics, at least in the philosophical tradition by many of the key philosophers, but also in animal research. I mean, language is very under-researched. It's becoming a topic of interest now, but it hasn't been for a very long time. Animals were only used to study aspects about human language. So, and now that we are studying their languages on their terms, we're actually finding out that these are much more complex than we always used to think. So the book came about because I was writing the PhD thesis and came across all of these studies, and then just really felt that there was a bigger story in it. And
You mentioned earlier a third book that will be coming out in English next year, the essay about depression, but you've called that The Limits of Language.
Yeah, it's actually a quote by Wittgenstein, the limits of my language, and I somehow knew that this would be the title of the book from the moment I started writing it. Titles are also a funny thing. Sometimes there's immediately a title and sometimes it takes a really long time and I sort of don't really know. But usually with the books that have a title at the beginning, they're among the easiest to write. So this book is, I think it's very much... So it's a philosophical investigation into the concept depression. A lot of books are being written, or have been written about depression, first-person narratives, self-help books, also more medical books that sort of seek a remedy for depression in our minds or bodies or something else. But I felt that there are actually quite a lot of important philosophical questions involved in depression. So, for example, the body-mind problem. So in philosophy, it's always the question of whether body and mind are actually connected, or it's not always a question, but some philosophers have posed it and then others challenged it. And depression is really a state that challenges this strict mind-body separation. It's also very related to existential questions. So I begin the book by writing about when I first read Sartre, for example, and Camus, and go sort of into the existentialist framework. It's also our ideas of madness and depression have a history. So I also, for example, draw attention to the work of Foucault's, his Genealogy of Madness shows that actually the way that we think about mental problems or psychological issues at the moment is really a product of our time. So I look at these different philosophers, and in that I continuously use my own experiences with depression as sort of a starting point. So it's sort of moving back and forth between the experience and the theory in order to shed some light on what's actually happening there, and also to investigate how to live with recurring depressions, because we live in a society in which everything seems to be a lot of people have a sort of consumerist attitude towards health. So if you are ill, you can get an operation or a pill, or you go into therapy and then it's fixed. Except that for a lot of people, it does not work like that. So they might become depressed again, or they might not heal. And then that's actually very difficult to solve within this sort of neoliberal paradigm of yeah, looking at health and success as well, because a lot of people feel it is an extra failure to be depressed and not heal if that is the expectation. So the book is also looking at being able to keep going and finding your way of doing that, because that will be different for everybody. So I discuss some of the things that I do, such as exercising. I like to run and I walk a lot with my dogs, and I'm very lucky to have the work that I do, because I can, well, the work is me and I'm the work, so I can really rely on that to also help me through the day when necessary. And I'm not depressed at the moment, so I'm doing really well. So it's not that I don't know if it's always easier to write it afterwards, of course. Mm-hmm. When you're depressed, it's of course very, the situation is harder. But the limits of my language are sort of, the title is referring to, on the one hand, being able to write a book about depression and actually, at least to myself and hopefully also to readers, being able to present some insights or at least a way of thinking about this phenomenon. And I've had a lot of letters from readers who were suffering from depression, but also readers who have people in their family or friends who are suffering from depression that thanked me for sort of giving them more insight in that. So that's really wonderful. But at the same time, it's also, it doesn't solve it, and it doesn't completely get to this kind of core loneliness that comes with depression. So it's also in vain. And that's, I think, that's inherent in language in a sense, because language creates connection, but it can also lead to a certain separation, because it's this abstract medium that you put between you and the other. And sometimes you can lose yourself in someone else's language, but there's also always this other way. So that is the title. So it's not specifically a book about language, but it is a book about trying to find words for something for which there might not always be words.
Finally, I just wanted to ask you about what you've been working on most recently. As the books we've been talking about, you obviously wrote a little while ago in Dutch, and they've only now come into English.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just wondering what you've been working on most recently. You mentioned a new novel coming out.
Yes, there's a new novel that I'm finishing now that is coming out next year in March, probably in Dutch, and that is called The New River, and it's a magical realist murder mystery set in a fictive country, and it begins with the murder of a soy farmer who also happens to be a poet. And the book was really nice for me to write because of the place. You know, it's set in this country that's just it's very colorful and very different from the Netherlands, for example. So for me, it was really nice to be able to go into that world and write it. And I also enjoy it because part of it is the poetry that the soy farmer wrote. Part of it is murder mystery. Part of it is more maybe social critique. Part of it is myth. So it's very much also about how these different ways of speaking about the truth impact our abilities to deal with a world that is changing. So maybe it's a book about climate change, but it's also a book about clashes of different knowledge systems. But it's also just really nice to read, I hope.
Well, I hope we'll be able to read it in English.
I hope so too.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, and thanks to Eva for chatting with Kate. If you have questions or want to get in touch with us, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Writers Centre. You can check out our Facebook page or head over to our website at nationalcentreforwriting.org.uk, where you can also sign up to our newsletter. And if you'd like to join our Discord chat area, you can follow the link down in the show notes. We are kicking off with our new book club at the moment. So if you want to get involved with that and read Bluebird, Bluebird by Attica Locke with the rest of us, then do join in and get reading.
Just got my copy from the library. I'm very excited to start.
Very good. I think I'm going to do the audiobook.
Oh, good choice. Yeah. We can compare and contrast, can't we?
It'll be indeed, yeah. Do you know what? I've never done an audiobook.
I don't think I have either. So, wow, your first audiobook is going to be Attica Locke's book. That'll be, yeah, you have to let me know how it is.
I'm quite excited. Apparently the audiobook is 9 hours long. So I feel like I should better squeeze that in over the next month or two.
That's not that long. The only audiobook I do have is at university. I studied Ulysses and it was so complex in places that I bought the audiobook in order to listen to chunks of it rather than trying to read it. And that is 22 hours long.
Wow. Yeah. Now, the only other audiobook I've attempted was Neverwhere by Neil Gaiman, which I bought because I was going on a transatlantic flight. And I thought, oh, I'll listen to an audiobook on the way over. That would be nice. And I basically fell asleep immediately on the plane, as I tend to, but had Neverwhere playing in my ears while I was asleep. And my dreams got very weird.
Very trippy. Please do subscribe, rate and review the podcast because it helps other people to find it. Thanks again. Keep writing and we'll catch you on the next episode.